You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club. Have a really exciting supplemental for you today, and I hope you will enjoy it. This comes from a panel at DragonCon that I just recently attended, and it is all about the character of Thrawn, then and now. And I was lucky enough to have with me on the panel Timothy Zahn, author and, of course, creator of Thrawn, as well as have Henry Gilroy, co-creator of Star Wars Rebels, crash the panel, and it's just fantastic listening to these guys go back and forth. And so I hope that you will enjoy the show.
I want you to give yourselves a round of applause for being here, because we did not expect there to be a full crowd today, so I'm really excited. It's been pretty awesome to be here at DragonCon. So my name is Matthew Rushing. I'm going to be moderating this panel today as we talk about Thrawn then and now. I am the host of the 602 Club podcast, as well as Aggressive Negotiations. And I'm just going to have everybody introduce themselves real quick, and then we'll get started.
Hey, I know about the 602 Club. I've been on that show.
Yeah!
I'm Bruce Gibson. I've been a guest on the 602 Club. I also am producer of the Star Wars Report podcast, and I co-host a podcast called Literary Treks, Star Trek Books and Comics.
Hi, I'm Kelly Hale. I'm with the 501st Legion out of the Dune Sea Garrison in Arizona. I am also the Thrawn that you saw at the celebration videos.
Hi, I'm John Liang. I'm a producer and an occasional contributor to the Beltway Banthas. It's a Star Wars and politics podcast based out of that other hive of scum and villainy, Washington, D.C.
I'm Timothy Zahn. I do not do a podcast. I did not read any of the books the first day they came out, so I have no idea why I'm here.
Wait, you haven't read the new Thrawn yet?
I just said I haven't read it the first day it came out.
Oh, okay.
Have you been on the 602 Club?
I don't think so.
No, we need to rectify that. Okay, so this is Thrawn then and now, and Thrawn is obviously a character that so many of us fell in love with back in 1991, or whenever you picked up a book somewhere. It was probably at the library or bookstore, or Walden Books, maybe, like me. And so I was just kind of curious for the panel. Even Tim, I wanted to ask you this question, and I want to kind of start with you. So you were contracted by Lucasfilm to basically continue the saga. So I wanted to know for you what your first experience with Thrawn was, and kind of getting what you wanted to do with that series and the character, and where all that kind of came from for you.
Well, technically it was Bantam who contacted me. They'd made an agreement with Lucasfilm, and Lucasfilm people had liked my style of the several samples that Bantam had sent to them. And I got the call and the invitation to do this. Thrawn's origin is when I was given the assignment, I wanted to do something that felt like Star Wars but was not what George had already done. So that meant no Death Star, no super weapon, no Vader type, no Emperor type. Okay, what else is there? Well, Vader rules by fear. The Emperor rules by manipulation. Someone who can lead by loyalty, I think, is more dangerous, because the troops will be united, they will follow his orders whether he's in the room with them or not. So, okay, what kind of person would the troops be loyal to? Someone who's a tactical genius. They know there's a good chance of that they will win whatever battle they are put into. Cares enough about the troops not to waste them in a futile effort if it seems like it's not working. Pull out, pick another time and place of your own choosing. Bunch of things came to mind that showed up in the original books. And finally, since the Emperor didn't seem to like aliens much, or non-humans, certainly in the top levels of his military, make him a non-human, because if he could make Grand Admiral, he must be something very special. And Thrawn just falls out of that calculation.
I've got a sort of political question for you in that case. What do you think Thrawn was more politically astute from a strategic point of view than his peers thought him to be?
That's an interesting question, because one of the things we brought out in the book Thrawn is that he does not do politics nearly as well, certainly not the cutthroat type of politics that Coruscant was running at in that era. I don't know how much he's had between Thrawn and the Thrawn trilogy. We've got, 10 to 15 years, depending which part of the new book you're in. There's time for him to learn that. On the other hand, in the Thrawn trilogy, he is basically in charge of everything Imperial. He doesn't have to play politics, because he will give the order and it will be obeyed. So I don't know if he's gotten more astute politically, or whether it's simply the politics haven't been as necessary for him to understand.
Yeah, it's kind of nice when you make the politics, you know, like everybody's bowing down to you, so that makes it different. I wanted to ask the rest of the panel just kind of what your first experience was with Thrawn, and what drew you to this character, and what keeps you kind of coming back to the character.
First read the original trilogy in 1997. I'd just gotten out of grad school and going to come back to D.C. I didn't have cable then, so I went to a bookstore, found your book and the entire trilogy, and just basically inhaled them. It was great. And then the new book, I was at AwesomeCon in Washington, D.C. last year when Bria, the moderator, was asking you, would you ever do another Thrawn book? And do not ever play poker with this man. She said, you know, you very astutely said, you know, well, they have my number. And then a month later, I'm watching the feed from Celebration London, and the cover pops up, and I'm going, pfft. So, yeah.
Bear in mind, I had signed 2 non-disclosure agreements at this point. The first one mentioned firstborn, the second one mentioned dominant kidney. So, you know.
Believe it or not, I started my Star Wars career 3 years ago right here at Dragon Con. And last year, I do normally a Royal Guard, and the head of the Imperial Officers Corps for the Legion came up to me knowing that I was talking about doing Thrawn, but I was going to do the original version that was had been removed from canon. And we knew that Thrawn was coming in from Celebration London from Rebels. And he walks up to me quietly after a party and says, "Hey, Kel, will you do Rebels?" I had no idea what he was roping me in for. Because we research a lot on our characters with the Legion, because you guys are so amazing. You come up with questions that we have no idea how to answer. And that's why I'm loving this panel. But I started with Thrawn, and then I started doing my research and spent a lot of time. I've probably read each book probably 16 times just to get through the little things that you guys ask. It's really hard to keep up sometimes. And I know in podcasts, everybody has those troubles too, that you get these questions, and you sit there and go, "How did you come up with that, Tim?"
"I don't remember."
So I was very, very blessed. I was very blessed that Tim also helped promote my Thrawn, and I'm so grateful to him. And I got to do something very special with him at Phoenix Comic Con, and he spent good time with me, helping me develop a little bit of my character to understand. So that's where I got a lot of my experience.
Wow. I'm sitting next to Thrawn. That's pretty cool. So my first experience with Thrawn was in 91 when Heir to the Empire came out. I was like many other people at that time that was just not seeing Star Wars anywhere. And all of a sudden, just seeing on a bookshelf, there's this blue cover with Star Wars on the top, and I'm like, oh, Star Wars, oh my gosh. And I'm like, oh my gosh, could this be maybe, because I see Luke and Leia and Han, and I see on the images on there, and I'm thinking, maybe is this the episode 7 that we probably would never get, but we're going to get? And then I see this name on the bottom that says Timothy Zahn. And I'm like, that's not George Lucas. I'm like, oh, this is a sign that we're probably never going to get in episode 7 if they've released this book. So I was thrilled at one point because we're getting a new Star Wars story, but not so thrilled because I thought it meant no more movies. But I read the book, I loved the book, and what I loved about Thrawn is exactly what you said. It wasn't just another Darth Vader.
For me, Star Wars was something that came into my life pretty early. I'm old enough that all the movies were out when I finally got to see them, but I'm not old enough to where I got to see them in the theater, so I just watched them all on VHS with my best friends for my birthday one. I think it was like 6 or 7, which was awesome because we woke up in the middle of the night and I put in my favorite already, which was Empire Strikes Back, and we watched it again. And I remember 1991 and walking around the mall with my parents, and there is a copy of that book in Walden Books, which doesn't exist anymore. And I fell in love with that idea because, you know, like every kid, I started writing my own fan fiction as a kid, like what I wanted to see. But then he did so much better, and I didn't have to worry about it anymore. so that was my experience with falling in love with Star Wars. And I mean, it was at that point where we thought we'd never get it again. You know, the way before the prequels, any of that stuff, you know, this was Star Wars. And he captured, Zahn, you captured it so perfectly. The feel, so I felt like I was reading 7, 8, and 9 when those books came out, and the character was different enough so I didn't feel like it was just a redo. It felt like a new challenge for our characters that they hadn't come up against, you know, and you put all these really cool things in their way, and it was just the character though is the thing that stuck out to me the most. And I wanted to ask you, you know, you've gotten to write Thrawn in all these different eras, which is so awesome because you get to explore kind of nuances to the character that you didn't in a different era. What were the nuances that you were able to explore in the new Thrawn book that you hadn't been able to before because of this being a different time period? And what were you excited to kind of reveal to us about the character that we didn't get to know before?
Largely, what was new was what you already mentioned. I hadn't had to deal with politics with him before on the same level I did with the book Thrawn. One of the things that we discussed back and forth with my editor and the story group, Lucasfilm people, was the idea that he doesn't do straight politics that well. Which is why we have people like Eli Vanto, who does understand more than he does, and why there can be an uneasy alliance, cooperation, whatever, with Governor Price, who also understands politics, to the regret of the people who pushed her into it in the first place. So that was really the newest thing of the character. The other part was, as I was writing, they were giving me access to the scripts of season 3 that Thrawn played, where Thrawn played a major role. And so I was able to see, okay, here is Governor Price hand to hand with Sabine. Okay, I can put in the book where she started getting interested in martial arts. We have Thrawn doing some hand to hand as well. I can put in a reason why he does do physical activity and have a scene, which meant I also could bring Hisishi in, who I've always liked. The other thing that I noticed is in all those scripts, we have meetings between Thrawn and Price, Tarkin, Yularen, and none of them in Rebels felt like a first meeting. So, okay, these people know each other, at least marginally. I can put their first contact, their first meeting into the book. The idea being to meld the book as closely with Rebels as I could. The other thing, it's not really what you asked, but I'm going to answer it anyway, is people often ask, you know, is this a different Thrawn than I'd written about originally? And the answer is no. mainly because the, and Henry can address this when he gets here, mainly because the Rebels team didn't do the, well, we like him, but let's remake him in our own image. No, they knew the character, they had grown up with him as well, and they made him the same character who's in my books, which meant that we're not rewriting the character, we're not changing him, all we're doing is putting him in different chunks of the timeline than he's ever appeared in before.
And that's something that I really love, because I do feel like he's consistent. Now, I'm gonna ask a question that my good friend Aaron Goins would ask if he were here, because I think the thing that threw people a little bit in the new book was the conversation that he has with Night Swan, where he reveals his motivation.
Okay. How many of you have not read Thrawn who are going to read it? Okay, so watch
earmuffs.
Watch for spoilers in this thing.
Spoiler alert now.
Can you dance around the question enough?
Yeah, just... You are able to kind of explain his motivations for actually even being a part of the Empire and why he does what he does. And I think that kind of threw people because they weren't expecting to kind of see maybe a part of him that isn't quite as villainous as what we were used to.
Well, you actually see a bunch of that in Spectre of the Past and Vision of the Future as well. So it's not anything really new. It's the idea that there are evil things out in the unknown regions. And we've come up with a reason why the unknown regions are still unknown, by the way. That's kind of cool. Hopefully in some future thing we can do that. The idea that he has decided the Empire is the best chance of uniting this part of the galaxy to defend against those. And the little teaser or hook for a future novel, if... that he had met Anakin, I will hopefully, again, if Lucasfilm allows it, be able to have Thrawn observing some of the Clone War stuff and seeing the chaos that the Republic has descended into, so when the Empire rises, he can see that that is, in his estimation, the best hope this part of the galaxy has. So again, I've got proposals to Del Rey. Lucasfilm is mulling at everything. Lucasfilm is slow these days. Apparently there's this movie that they think will bring in more money than books. I don't understand it. So if and when we get clearance, we'll be able to get something like that out. But I've got some ideas for the future whenever they let me.
I'm going to a little bit tag on to that. When we get... Spoiler, when we get to do in the early stages of the newest Thrawn book, we have that introduction with Anakin and Thrawn in a reference with the Chancellor. Mm-hmm. And we sort of almost get an impression that Anakin really doesn't share a lot of information about the Chiss at that point. Mm-hmm. Because it's almost like the way you write it that Palpatine is not very well educated about Thrawn at all. But he has such a great, the way he speaks about Anakin, it's such a high regard for Anakin. Is the true allegiance to Anakin, or is it to Palpatine?
Really good question. Hopefully I'll get to answer that someday.
I tried, guys.
Okay, so one thing about, well, actually I have two questions. One's really quick. Thrawn rhymes with Zahn.
Okay, I know this question. No, it's not deliberate. What happened was, in the early stages of plotting for the Thrawn trilogy, I briefly flirted with the idea that Thrawn is a little bit mentally not quite stable because he's the only non-human in the hierarchy, the top levels of the military. I dropped that idea very quickly and moved all of that to Sabaoth instead. But I had come up with a name already, and I like the name. Thrawn is Scottish for twisted. So that's where that came from.
Twisted.
Also, back in the 60s when I was watching Man from U.N.C.L.E., I always liked the THR combination of thrush. Oh, so nice. Combined that, I didn't want to change it, even though the reason for the name was no longer there.
Cool. All right, so the other thing I'm wondering is there's so much about the Force that plays upon all the stories in Star Wars. So I know that Thrawn doesn't really use the Force, but what is Thrawn's interpretation or his relationship and his thoughts about the Force?
Well, he's seen it in action, so he understands that there is something there. I don't think he knows how to codify it or understand it, you know, on a basic level. It's not like hardware that he can get the parameters of and figure out how to defeat. I will mention part of my problem with the Clone Wars was always the Jedi are as powerful as they have to be for this episode. You know, if they have to dig 20 feet of rock out to get somebody, or you know, they can't quite, you know, lift this guy off the ground as he's running away with something. The inconsistency, which is always a danger when you've got something like a Force, telekinetic powers or whatever. But I think Thrawn knows it's there. On some level, can fight it, but on another level, it's just not easy to figure out. I do note that in how many of you have not seen season 3 of Rebels who plan to see it? Okay, I can dance a little bit around this. At the end, in that final episode, you'll note that his first threat is to Kanan. So he is picking on the one who is the most powerful to make his, you know, do this or the Jedi dies type of thing. So he understands at least that the Jedi are powerful. If I can take this one down, I can take the rest of them, and they will all know that.
I have a question on that, because in some ways he doesn't have the light side or dark side. But however, he does have a power that's really, as you say, loyalty. That charisma that he carries,
yeah,
is almost as powerful as any Force power. And if you look at other characters, almost their same charisma makes them have that strength. And that's the way I interpret, yeah, that phrasing. Because even with his pets, he rebels their powers. But at the same time, he almost has his own charisma and Force sensitivity in one way.
And you can say, I mean, you can talk about a lot of people with charisma, and some of them can back up that charisma. It's all soap bubble. You know, look at Bernie Madoff and such, people who have conned people out of millions of dollars. They had charisma. Thrawn's charisma is different in that he can deliver. It's more like the "it ain't bragging if you can do it" type of thing. So his charisma is backed up with solid ability, which is kind of a double threat type of thing in there.
Yeah.
Is that Henry Gilroy back there? Hey, why don't you come up and talk about some Thrawn with us? You know Henry Gilroy, Bruce, who writes and created Rebels and worked on the Clone Wars and... Yeah, okay, that's who he is. Okay.
He's important enough that we saved two chairs for him.
That's right.
And I wouldn't exist if you didn't exist.
There's one chair for my ego. Or you could probably say the Blue Ghost, Filoni. He was going to kill me if I say anything wrong.
Well, welcome to the panel, Henry.
Oh, thank you very much. Can I interject something right away?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Tim, and it's not a correction so much as just an addition. When Thrawn threatens Hera by threatening Kanan by saying, "I'm going to kill the Jedi first," there's two things that actually, even though he had no direct contact or very little direct contact, the things that he's figured out is, number one, that Hera is in command. So he knows that basically he's giving her the ultimatum, which is, I'm going to kill your most powerful, but also, being Thrawn, he's probably figured out, you know, # space married.
Yeah. Right. Nice.
So he knows this is a family environment. He knows, he's watched them. He's seen what they'll do for each other. Earlier, that moment was really set up in an earlier moment in Hera's Heroes, where he lets them get away, because he's really willing to see, what are these people willing to do for each other? What are they willing to sacrifice? She blew up her own home.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, now I understand that this family unit is more important to each other than a place that they would live in.
And when I talk about what a good job they did with Rebels, that is one of the points that Thrawn has figured out that whole thing just from his observations, watching them, etc. And I think that's an excellent, very nice touch that you guys put in there.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, I know that there was some, you know, I'd heard some rustling around that, well, why is Thrawn always letting them, you know, get away? It's weakening Thrawn as a character. And you know, the way we saw it is that this is a chess game. And he's moving pawns around, but he's really trying to see about the skill of his opponent. Obviously, he's heard that the Inquisitors were defeated, you know, and, you know, even, you know, Vader had his issues, so this is a resourceful group. So, but also he's looking at a far larger picture, which is to bring down the entire rebellion if he can.
And if you are trying to bring down a group, it is, there's an extreme advantage in knowing one of them who is still in charge. If you swat Hera, someone come to take her place, and you're back at square one. If you understand her a little, if you're gaining knowledge about this core group, you know, Hera, Sabine, Ezra, etc., you know some of these people, you know, therefore, you can get an idea of how their tactics and the tactics of everybody they come up with or join up with will be. You have that advantage.
That's something that I wanted to ask you, Henry, specifically about, you know, bringing Thrawn in. Because so we had Inquisitors first season. Season two, Vader. And now we have a character who has no, you know, force ability, and he comes in and is a force of nature for these characters. What was it like for you and the writing team figuring out the ways in which our heroes were going to interact with this new type of villain, and really setting apart, I think, season three from the previous two seasons?
Yeah, the previous two seasons you had the threats of the Inquisitors. And what I like to approach is, and just like the films, there's a pattern of you have a mystical threat, and the mystical threat is Inquisitor to Ezra and Kanan in season one, and then more Inquisitors show up in season two. But then there's like the you know, the addition that our heroes get with Ahsoka's help, so that sort of balances it out. And then you end season two with, oh my gosh, you know, or beginning and end is you have Vader, and you end it with Maul. So the mystical threat in season three was going to be the Maul Ezra conflict, but we really didn't have like our kind of military threat. You think about season one, you know, you have you know, Agent Kallus sort of kind of running the show, and then when Tarkin gets involved, that goes terribly wrong for the heroes. So I think kind of raising the bar is more, as our heroes get more powerful, so do the bad guys, you know, for all intent purposes. So the idea is who could we bring in season three that isn't necessarily the mystical threat, but who would basically be almost an overwhelming military threat to this group of rebels. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the things I liked about how you guys brought Thrawn in is you kept his use of looking at his adversary's art as a way of him analyzing how their, what their weaknesses are and that kind of thing. And the one artist in Rebels is Sabine, which terrifies me because I'm thinking she's going to be the first one to be bumped off.
Right.
And so actually a more lighter question is, out of all your crew members, you and your crew members, what's an average number of times that you have read the original Thrawn trilogy?
Oh my gosh. You know, I can nerd out and say, yeah, I read it 91 too, and I had a very similar thing of walking into the bookstore and seeing what, this doesn't say George Lucas. I looked in the inside cover and said story by, and it said nothing about George Lucas. Who's Tim Zahn? I mean, it's sort of like a Star Wars name, you know, but it is. I mean, there was an idea we were going to have a guy named Zahn Timo, I think. I had pitched an idea for Zahn Timo, and it was going to be basically a guy who messed up on the bridge, and Thrawn ejected him out of the airlock. And because in Star Wars, you know, characters always murder their father, so it just made sense thematically. I don't think it. I don't think it ever made it to script. But sorry, you'll live to see another day.
I if that happens, I want a screenshot or something. I want to look like that so I can go into the Walk of Fame and sell pictures, and not have to lug
yes.
not have to lug 200 pounds of books across the country.
But yeah, that was my first exposure to the book, and I read all three books, and it was a fantastic new edition. And what I liked about it was, oh, this is something I haven't seen before. And, you know, there was lots of goofy stories in the Star Wars comics in the 70s and the 80s, but I really loved Tim's books because I think they brought us a whole new way. And, you know, obviously enduring stuff, you know, at Lucasfilm. Lucasfilm's really making an effort to, you know, mine the Legends material for stuff that we all love, that resonates with us. You know, I think that, you know, who knows what's going to, you know, show up next for Legends. So.
Always bear in mind that the heroism of the heroes is measured by the villainy of the villain. If it's a pushover villain, the heroes don't have to do much, you know, knock them over a little bit. If the villain is extremely powerful, they have to bring their A game. If it's a villain like Thrawn, where they can't get out of it with just a lightsaber duel or something, now we have to kind of outthink and outact and anticipate more than we ever had to before. So it brings a whole new level of how do we fight this guy?
Yeah, you can't. I mean, it's one of those things where if you're on his playing field, you lose. It really is. I mean, I really kind of loved the new Thrawn novel, how you have the Eli character who is sort of the Watson to his Sherlock, because you really can't understand what's going on in Thrawn's head, and I think that's why he's so effective. He's 8 steps ahead and all the time. And when you try to talk to someone who's that far ahead, you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. It's like, yeah, you will in a half an hour, though. It's that kind of thing. So Thrawn is that guy. So, and we never wanted to, you know, sacrifice that or have him, you know, get beaten cheaply. It's always in a way that for something he couldn't quantify, like we were discussing the Force. The Force is something that it has a maddening effect on him because he can't predict it. There's no tactical precognition no tactical analyzing is going to help him for something that's ethereal, that's mystical. Please share.
And the other way is to give him something he can't control. In the last battle, for example, the order to take prisoners, a couple of things in there that you guys also understand. If he can't control it, it will mess with his calculations. Again, you're right. If you play in his field, if he's got perfect knowledge or sufficient knowledge and sufficient control, you will not beat him.
Yeah, and we set that moment up where Constantine moves his ship out of position back actually in episode 8 when he sends Constantine out to take care of this planet by himself with one ship. And he basically, for all intents and purposes, humiliates Constantine.
Yeah.
And even right when they first meet in the first two-parter, Constantine's like, yeah, you know, Grand Admiral, when did you become a Grand Admiral? Because he already is like, okay, this guy is moving out of my territory. So he wanted to establish that these guys already doesn't, you know, at least Constantine doesn't like Thrawn because he sees him a threat. Thrawn doesn't care. He knows this guy's a bozo and he's just going to, you know, move him out of the way. So,
but I suspect, and one of the reasons I put so much politics into the military in the book was I suspect Constantine is too highly placed to be kicked out, you know, counting, you know, neutrons in the piles over at Yavin or something. He's too powerful, therefore that's, you know, people have asked, why is he still there? He probably knows people.
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing where it's, I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe you're going to do the Constantine novel next, but I mean, there is that backstory to him, so yeah, I think you're right on, but this is Ezra's show, and so we really want to spend our time with the Rebels and hashtag space married. See, I caught her texting, so. but no, just the relationships of our family are what's most important. So we really wanted to actually have Thrawn be aware of these relationships and actually be able to exploit them.
I wanted to ask you, because watching season 3, I've been thinking a lot about Hot Callus, and maybe that sounds weird, but I've been thinking, yeah, I know, who hasn't, but I've been thinking about his arc, and I'm wondering, since we have you here, is seeing Thrawn's resolve and the way that he will go about things, was that the last straw for Callus to finally, like, nobody cares about me? We saw that in season 2 when he comes back, nobody cares, I'm back. And then was working under Thrawn like that last straw? Like, he just sees that the Empire, we don't care about anything but ourselves and getting these whatever results. And like, that's something that really struck me, the fact that seeing this tactical genius who's willing to do whatever he has to do to take down these enemies, I don't know, did that have any impact?
Yeah. He knows that Thrawn will do whatever the Emperor requires. So, and I think that it probably starting out, I like to think of Kallus somewhat like Anakin, where he's trying to do the right thing. He wants to make the galaxy a better place. And I think on Onderon, he realized like, oh yeah, you know, boy, this was rough. You know, I lost a lot of my guys. And then, you know, he went to Lassan, and that wasn't supposed to be this genocide. And so, which he, you know, explains to Zeb in that, the bromance episode, we call it, Ice Planet Bromance. So I think the idea of you a lot of times find that the guy on the other side of the line or the other guy who's shooting at you, he's trying to protect his family, he's trying to do the right thing, what he thinks is right. So it's people in the Empire who are not bad people. They're trying to enforce order and they think they're doing a good thing, but you know, they don't know how poisonous is at the top. Obviously, as Kallus has gone up the chain of command, he's seen like, wow, there's terrible stuff happening. And he, you know, we kind of tried to set up some of that with the Inquisitor in season one, that he really doesn't like the Inquisitor because of this mystical stuff. And the Inquisitors would do stuff that weren't in the chain of command and were unethical and cruel. And so that's the sort of thing where you go, that probably he started asking questions back then. So his arc is kind of a long change, but yeah, he was trying to do the right thing. And it's interesting, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, is Fulcrum, you know, Kallus for season three? But if you look at all the pieces, there are a lot of hints that kind of show, you know. I think also there's a scene we put in the Zeb story before the Ice Planet, where it's kind of the Zeb, I kind of like to call it the Zeb Moses story, where he finds the home planet for Lirasan, I think, is the planet. I wrote it. Sorry. There's so many episodes. That episode, even though he's really gung-ho, the fact that the rebels are able to escape this seemingly inescapable location is the start of him realizing, like, who's helping these people? How are they able to do this stuff? There's like something that he couldn't quantify. So it's a similar aspect to Thrawn, where underneath it, it's like, there's a reason I keep getting beat. And is some of it have to do with myself? Mm. And realizing that maybe I'm not on the right side. So.
That's really cool. I'm going to ask them one more question, but as we're doing that, everybody who would like to ask a question, please line up, because I know you guys would love to ask questions of these amazing gentlemen. But I wanted to ask yous on, before we do that, going back to that conversation and what we see Thrawn do in the newest book, where he is somebody who does seem to care about life. What is it that does set Thrawn apart from your average Imperial, like a Constantine or just somebody else, that makes him, it's not just that he's Chiss, but what is it that, because he seems to have this moral center to him that's quite interesting, because I don't know if we've completely understood that always.
Well, it boils down to he's got his agenda. His agenda is safety first for his people, second safety for whoever he is pledged allegiance to, in this case the Empire. When you start with that, you are going to try to defeat your enemies in the most efficient and bloodless way possible, because you don't want to waste lives, you don't want to waste equipment, you don't want to waste planets. So he's going to have that moral core. Some people have complained, if there's any complaint about Thrawn, it's the episode where he has the saboteur sit on the speeder bike and blow up. And I've tried to explain to them, look, this guy has killed Imperials with his sabotage. He is for the death penalty anyway. This way, you send a message to any other saboteurs. You also send a message to anybody who's slacking off in a screw-up. You better pay attention to your job, or else you might wind up on one of these bikes as well. So he has not killed someone who the Empire would not execute anyway if they went through a trial and all of that. and it is a very efficient way of sending the message to everybody. So again, that's an efficient way of doing it. We're not going to allow more sabotage, but it's at the cost of one life that's already forfeit. We are going to make sure this doesn't happen again, or at least they have to think long and hard about doing it.
Yeah, I just add, and absolutely, you're absolutely right. There is this thing that we tried to bring out, which is he doesn't want to destroy art. And if he can win the battle bloodlessly by forcing a complete surrender, he will, because there's probably a lot of great, fantastic paintings down there he would like to look at. So,
forget the people. They don't really matter. It's the art.
Yeah, if as long as they bend a knee, right, and continue to do sketches in Artist Alley, everything will be fine.
We're all safe right now.
But I think that really makes him, I want to say, human, unlike the other, like there's a lot of bad guys, I'll just destroy everything. Like, Price doesn't have that compunction, and that's one reason why he doesn't respect her, is because she is so narrow-sighted about power. He's not interested in power. He's in it for the game. He loves the victory of it, and obviously, you know, overcome the adversaries, but ultimately, yeah, it's like the Emperor wants to bring order, he's going to do it most efficiently. So, but that doesn't mean he wants to blow up everything. He blows up only what he has to, I think.
Yeah, thinking about his little monologue in Hera's Heroes, this is the kind of guy who would never say, "You rebel scum." This is the kind of guy who would say, "I understand you, I respect you, but you are my enemy. If you remain in my way, I will destroy you." But his comments to Hera, okay, there's a little bit of an edge to them, maybe a little bit of sarcasm, but you can sense an actual, "I respect you, you are a warrior just like I am." And that is one of the things that will set him apart from most of the other Imperials we've ever seen.
And he's also that guy who would totally snipe you on eBay for that sketch you really want. He's that guy.
Yep.
Go for it.
So I actually had stated beforehand pretty publicly and was wrong, and I hate being wrong, that with the Thrawn novel, I said, okay, this is going to be the back door to see Talon Card enter into canon. And I was like, oh man, now I look like an idiot. Is that something that we expect to see at some point, though, or?
Okay, first of all, let me reiterate, I have ideas and proposals out at Del Rey, but Lucasfilm has to pass on everything, and Lucasfilm is moving kind of slow these days. The second thing is, while it is tempting to bring in Talon Card or this Mara person or Pelion, the thing is, if you start bringing too many people into too small a space, the galaxy gets smaller. You know, Charles Dickens had the same problem. He just had England to work with, and people kept running into each other. You also don't want, you remember what Henry was talking about the build-up to where Thrawn, it makes sense to bring Thrawn into Rebels. We've tried everything else. This group is starting to grow and become a more serious threat. Okay, now we bring in the big gun. You don't want to bring in Talon Card, Mara Jade, anybody else, unless it makes sense within the context of the time period, the show, etc. Frankly, I don't think there's any room for any of these guys in season four because you've got all these other plot threads, relationships, everything to work through to the conclusion. Whatever they do after Rebels, I don't know, I assume you have something in the works. Maybe something would make it worth doing or make it make sense to do. But I am frankly just perfectly happy to let you guys do what you do because you're doing it so well and wait for, if it's the right time, right place, bring in some other characters. If it's not, we don't.
I have two, and I'm sorry, guys. Season four being the last season of Rebels, I'm worried about the possible expiration date on Thrawn, honestly. But to me, and I'm glad you said Pelion, because to me, he was that continuing conscience on the part of the Empire. He took those lessons from Thrawn, he took them to heart, and he applied those to the Empire. And I want to see that, not necessarily Gil-Ad himself, but that character that the Thrawn mentors and learns from. And he takes those Thrawn ideals and morals into the future of the Empire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know that's really... thank you. It's like, this is my stock answer, which is watch Rebels season 4. Stay tuned to season 4. I actually love Paleon. I don't know what the future holds to be, completely honest, but I really liked Paleon too, that he kind of showed the humanness, or he was that human character that we as a reader could identify with and kind of see his growth.
Right.
You know, I think Eli's the same character, or has a similar aspect.
Similar role, but different dynamic. Yeah.
Right.
And then for you, Timothy, I know you can't speak of a lot because everything has to get passed. So just in generalities, what do you want to see for Thrawn that you have control of? I mean, that you would be able to do, what do you want to see for Thrawn, I guess?
I have proposals in for Del Rey. No, seriously, I mean, this is what, I have proposals in for what I would like to do for Thrawn for the next, I probably have two proposals in. Our son has pointed out the problem that if I do three books, two sequels to Thrawn, we have a second Thrawn trilogy, which will be confusing. His solution is we do four books, and it's a tough.
Genius. My money.
My editor's comment when I mentioned this, she turned to a colleague and said, "See how smoothly he did that." But I will keep writing as long as you are interested, and I have ideas that I think you will enjoy reading, and Lucasfilm lets me.
Hi, I have a question for both Timothy and Henry. And I know you said you can't talk too much about like what's happening in season 4 and all that, but I have a two-part question. Okay. At the end of season 3, you talked about how when Thrawn identified, he knows what the Force is, you know, he understands that it's out there. But then he came across, and not to spoil it for anybody, something that is more than just a mortal with the Force.
Yeah, that's why he's like, what the heck?
Yeah, and so right. I just did that. You think that phased him? Like, okay, this is like almost a godlike being. Does that like just kind of make him go, okay, I got to reorganize my priorities?
Yeah, I mean,
would me?
Yeah.
I mean, well, I'm just saying. I mean, nothing seems to phase him otherwise. So I mean,
that's
aside from you grabbing his art, and then he goes crazy.
That's like a physicist seeing a ghost.
Well,
it's that sort
okay,
of thing.
And then the second part of that question is okay. Well, when that one character hinted at Thrawn's potential demise, is that a direct reference to how he was killed in Legends? Because remember, in Legends, his assassin, who I think we're getting in season 4, his little personal assassin.
25-year-old spoilers.
Yeah. I was going to say, wait a second. I know some people want to read the books,
but
the old books.
Is that Legend a book. Reference to his demise from Legends?
Oh, no. Oh. Or yes.
Henry, since I do Thrawn, and one of the fun things about that is...
You're a great Thrawn, by
when
the way.
Thank you so much. When you put him in the AT-ST bucket, and for those of you that don't know that term, we normally are referring to our helmets. When you put him in the armor, it was really interesting because... It gave that really military transition and gave that almost history that Timothy had given us from the very beginning, which I really appreciated. One, we always love more costumes. We'll never deny that. But what motivated you to go into that hard armor in that scene?
Oh, I mean, it's something we kind of set up in the earlier episode 16, which was the...
The battle droids?
Right. Through Imperial Eyes. The idea of... Thrawn, to really understand war, to really understand combat, you have to experience it. And most generals who are worth anything, a lot of people see like, oh, they've spent their time on the front line or in the trenches. So the idea he's just like a tactical guy who sits back and plays other people's lives didn't really make sense. Also, he knew that actually the only way he was going to get a surrender is if he went down there and did it himself. So it was practical, but it was also like, yeah, I'm basically going to go down there and make sure this gets done right. Because, and as you see, what happens? He leaves space, and Price totally messes up. So, and Ezra gets away. So, he can't be everywhere at once. But wherever he is, there's a really good chance he's going to win.
Thank you.
And for myself, I appreciate you actually let him put on armor and a helmet, because one of our big annoyances is the hero going into the battle without the helmet. The helmet's for our purpose.
And also, you know, I'm sure the people at Hasbro were jumping up and down. So got to make them happy too. But we, I mean, it had a practical reason. There were reasons that had to do with the character, really, besides the plot. So.
First of all, thank you for the books. Literally, one of my favorite childhood memories with my father was him reading those books to me over anything else, because he always came home for reading time. One question I have is, I know that the character that is Thrawn is way bigger in your head than will ever make it onto paper or has ever been on paper thus far. Is there any aspect to Thrawn that really was guiding you in writing that never really you could get onto paper, like a component of him that you feel like didn't come across in the books?
Nothing comes to mind. I've been very fortunate in being allowed to write him pretty much as I want to. Within the parameters, obviously, with the new book, parameters of Rebels and such. But there's no, gee, I wish I could bring out this aspect that I've got in mind. I'm pretty much got them. He's pretty much what you see is what you get with Thrawn.
We have about 10 minutes left, so just keep that in mind for your questions.
Okay, I just like, Logan, you're stalking me. This is like the fourth panel.
Okay, no, you just, no, you're stalking me, because I'm always here before you.
Oh. Touché. The apprentice becomes the master.
In a Doctor Who panel, that wouldn't work.
So, in Star Wars Rebels Season 3, in, the scene where the sentry droids are attacking Thrawn in his office, Commander Gree's helmet is seen there. Like, I just want to know, like, why it's there besides the fact that it looks awesome.
I feel like that's a Dave Filoni question.
Dave's not going to answer that.
He might. He might answer that.
Maybe?
I actually think that really it comes down to artistic aesthetic. It's a cool paint job. And as we can see, from that episode, Ezra's paint job on his helmet ends up, causing all sorts of trouble for the Rebels. But that's the sort of thing that we want to say, oh, hey, you know what, he pays attention to this stuff. So the fact that he already had a painted helmet in there, I think two, it just makes sense.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
So as an Army officer who's been in Afghanistan, I want to say I appreciate the effort that has gone into creating the universe that is Thrawn, both in the book and the show. I think it's very accurate as somebody who's been on the ground there. I wanted to touch on a point that you made, Henry, about Thrawn being in it for the game. So, my role in Afghanistan was advising on the rules of engagement, the law of war, right? So this game implies rules, right? War has rules to it. And generally, we see Thrawn willing to abide by those rules. But between Batan in the novel, Adalon, where he tells Hera, I'm not accepting surrenders at this time, we see him maybe willing to bend these rules. Is Thrawn at his core willing to set the rules of the game aside if victory is the ultimate objective?
Well, actually, I think what's interesting is Price really is the one who causes the issue on Batan. And actually, if you watch 321 again, Thrawn goes, I'm not, basically, what he's saying is you can't beat me when he says, I'm not accepting surrenders at this time. Because he doesn't immediately attack. If you notice, he sits back and waits. Mm-hmm. He makes them move into position to try to escape. So really, they drive into the jaws of him. So when he says that, he goes like, look, it's no point. There's no point. Like, so the fact that she's like, okay, he's going to ask for a surrender. He's like, no, there's no point. He knows they're going to fight. So he's ahead of her is what that's really about. So as far as like the rules of engagement, I think there are in his head because he wants to see the best that his opponent can give him. Show me what you got. And
thanks.
So that's what he's about.
Thanks.
Anyway, I'm sorry. You want to add?
No, I want to add a couple of points. First of all, the first thing they showed me after they told me that Thrawn was going to be in Rebels was the scene of Thrawn and Price coming aboard and the whole question of the Battle of Batan coming up. And my first thought it was, a bunch of civilian deaths? That doesn't sound like Thrawn. My second thought was, he's covering for somebody. My third thought was, he's covering for her, which is... That was where I was aiming to end the book in the first place. Second thing, you notice that even though he says I'm not accepting surrender. Later in the episode, he does call for surrender. So part of it is what Henry is saying of, you know, give me your best shot. And part of it is he knows that often if you ask for surrender, they are going to start hemming and hawing and talking about terms. In fact, he's seen this, and stalling for time, and he's not going to give them that chance.
I want to follow up on that really quick. How many of those rules that he has, how many of those are imperial rules that he learned, and how many of them are Chiss rules that he has brought with him from back way back when?
I would guess a lot are either Chiss or his own internal rules.
Yeah, in the book he's like getting Korshmar literally 6 pages, Tim, for breaking some rules. So I think he does what he needs to do to win. And then what's the great thing about it is even though he gets court-martialed, they can't argue with success. Yeah. So then he just gets promoted. So isn't that the way?
Another defense counsel.
Well, I mean, that was part of the fun of doing the book is he's on his rise through the ranks. He's going to come up with people who really understand that he is an asset, a valuable asset, and willing to learn or to use him. Others who will learn from him, like Eli. Others who will hate his guts because he shows them all up. And he's going to run into all of those. And you're right, he's getting court-martialed by the ones whose noses are bent out of shape. But the high command, as you say, you can't argue with success.
So he wrote the book on how to be sticky in the Empire? Like, you know, you make yourself indispensable and...
Right. I think he had his guidelines, you could say. I always look at him as like approaching combat with a certain kind of protocol, and he has manners about it. So I think that's an interesting thing. Like you kind of get a sense of that when you know, Captain Slavin, I think on the Harris Hero, is going to destroy Harris' piece of artwork, and he like you see that emotion from him. Like, what are you talking about? You're not going to destroy that. This, it has more meaning than you do, is what he's saying right then. It's really kind of interesting.
Henry Gilroy, is that the name?
Henry Gilroy.
Okay, great. I'm glad you're up there, because although this is directed towards you, Tim, I want to hear your input as well. Okay, you know, obviously we're talking about, hey, who knows what other legends, and we got that announcement earlier at Celebration of Rook. You know, going to be in season 4. So, and I think, did they say Warwick Davis was going to be his voice?
Yep.
Okay. So, Tim, how does that feel knowing that Rook's going to be in there, and then maybe he can go a little bit more into whatever he can tell?
Well, what happened in the books was a specific set of circumstances that do not exist in this time period. So I'm not particularly worried. My hope and guess, and you can talk about this, except you probably can't, is that the reason to bring Rook in is so we can have some real kick-ass fights between him and Zeb. That's what I'm looking for.
Yes.
I don't know, in that trailer, we see Rook and Hera going at it. Did you notice that? It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That's really exciting. And again, you're going to have our military bad guys, as we were talking about, and you have your sort of mystical / physical kind of bad guy.
Next question.
Overall, I just want to thank you for the Thrawn novels. The first one I bought physically, the rest of the new canon I've been buying on Kindle.
Thank you.
Hi, I have a question for Timothy.
Yeah.
One thing I really like about all the different Thrawn books is the relationship between Thrawn and his Watsons. Bring back Pelion, please. But I really like that even though Pelion and George and Eli meet him all at different times in his life, he always has kind of like a mentally relation with them. So I was wondering if you were playing up the side of Thrawn as a mentor more as the books went on.
That's part of it. The Watson is like a companion for the Doctor. This is who you explain things to so the audience can get it as well. But partly it's to bring out you look at the contrast between how he deals with Eli and how he deals with Slavin, for example. Or Slavin, sorry. Slavin is not teachable. Eli is. And someone who is a master of something is always looking for someone who will listen, who can be teachable, who can be taught, and who is, you know, wants to be taught. And even though Eli doesn't catch on right away that this is something I want, Thrawn can recognize it in him. Same with Pelion, same with George Cardass. But yeah, it's partly a mechanism. It's partly a, these are the guys he will glom onto because these are the people who he can talk to.
Thank you.
Go for it.
Yeah. Quick aside, Kelly, I don't know if you're taking off. I'm trying to get in the Thrawn cosplay. I don't know if you have to be somewhere afterwards. I'd love to be able to pick your mind. If so, that's fine.
What you could do is message me from the Dune Sea Garrison. I can answer your questions from there. Unfortunately, I've got to go right after.
No problem. Thank you. My question is, the thing that really drew me to Thrawn in the beginning is I love the morality question. This gray character, he's not just bad. Like, there's all this whole Empire bad, Rebel good has been that way for quite a while, and I love exploring that gray area more. My question is, in your respective universes, is a chance to explore that a little bit more. Maybe like Empire people that are for the Empire, but more for reform, or people in the Rebellion that are more, they just skirt the line of terrorism, that kind of thing. I really just enjoy that aspect of the characters.
Well, we've done the one with Saul Guerrera, who is becoming more of a terrorist than a rebel, and he's been kicked out. As to the other side, the Allegiance and Choices of One books I did explore the five stormtroopers who wound up defecting and wind up being kind of an A-team Robin Hood, Zorro type of unit of there is injustice here, the Empire is not paying attention, this is what we signed up to fight, let's go do it. So I've done a little bit of that. I would like to do more.
For you and Rebel?
Yeah, it's funny, we had a discussion about that, because, you know, a lot of terrible things happen to stormtroopers, like in every episode of Rebel, so they all can't be bad guys, but the way we kind of try to look at it is probably a lot of people who signed up for the Empire initially were like, oh great, I'm a bully and I get to go bully people. And so, you know, you shouldn't feel bad about them, I think. but I think that as time goes on, you realize, like, oh, wait, I'm not such a bad guy, and I've kind of been drawn into this, and, wow, I'm working for the devil. I think that you might actually be able to change your mind, and I think that there have been some great stories. And even in, you know, The Force Awakens, you kind of get a sense of that, you know, with Finn. So,
sort of even get a feel with that with Kallus in Rebels, that he sees the error almost of his ways when he finally reveals himself as that spy. I think you really see his, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, that realization of I'm working for the bad guys. I've become what I hate, and I think that's something that we see that happen in the Star Wars thematically, kind of through the stories.
Thank you.
Hi, sorry. So I just wanted to ask two quick questions. I want to know, what was all of y'all's favorite Thrawn quote? And if Timothy could sign this book for me.
I can do about maybe 5 or 10 minutes, unless they want everybody out, because I've got another panel to go to. But
I think my favorite Thrawn quote is when he's talking about in the Rebels, and he just says, we'll see their destruction. And like, it's just, it's so chilling, and the voice work for Rebels, I mean, it was the absolute perfect. He's never rushed. He's always calculating, and everything he says, he means to come out of his mouth, except for that one moment when he wants to kill that guy for wanting to destroy art, and it's like, he loses that cool for a second, and then it's back. So, yeah, I love that.
And yet, I've covered that in the book. It's either he lost control, or deliberately trying to break the pattern because this guy doesn't seem to pay attention any other way.
I don't know if I have a favorite quote because I can't think of one that's a favorite, but anytime he answers something similar to elementary, my dear Watson.
Mine has to be when he's holding Hera's trophy. Allegory. You know, it really is, for him, it's a trophy. It's more than just her allegory. And him basically demonishing everybody in the room by not knowing what it was, because he was such a master at artifacts. Mm.
Mine really isn't a quote, it's more, it was in the book, in the new book, and you had a line, and the starship with a flicker of pseudo motion went into space, because those were always in the original trilogy, and I had a complete, you know, geek out moment. Oh my God, I can't, yes. So I love that line.
Well, I just want to thank everybody for being here today. This is our last panel for Star Wars at Dragon Con, and it has been an honor. Oh, there's one more, excuse me. But it's been an honor to be here with you guys. Wanted to mention real quick, there is going to be a Thrawn comic adaptation coming out, yeah. So we have more Thrawn to be looking forward to.
There is a Marvel adaptation, 6-part adaptation of Thrawn coming out. First episode, I think, is in February. If there are enough sales, we will try to pitch original stuff for a Thrawn series. So, you know, buy 6 copies each.
And if you want some Thrawn sooner than that, Star Wars Rebels premieres October 16th. And, 4th and final season. I get a lot of you folks going to be here next year, probably? Okay, I'd like to do next year a panel just on how we write Star Wars.